Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying, and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.
Coming up on this episode of White Wine Question Time.
He came to eat at the Hand of Flowers and not once did he never stop being Liam Gallagher. He spent the whole lunch with his cagoule on, like zipped up to the top. He ate, he was drinking espresso martinis from the right from the start all the way through to the end. And when he finished it, when he finished at lunch, he moonwalked into the kitchen to thank all the chefs. So we've lost, I don't know, pandemic, probably on paper, around about four million quid. We lost 4 million, right? Real terms cash was about 1.5. We lost 1.5 million quid, right?
Tom.
If not more. This guy might be able to do whatever he does on a corporate, understand the corporate spreadsheet of working out the balance of profit and loss over a multi-billion pound company. But he can't cook two Michelin stars, can he, mate? Come in.
Welcome to White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks its guests three thought-provoking questions, usually over three glasses of wine. But not this week. For a start, my guest is teetotal, but we are at his brand new pub, the Butcher's Tap and Grill in Chelsea, which has literally just opened. And this isn't his first time on the show. He's back in true chef style for second helpings. Although since he was last on, we've ended up inadvertently on holiday together and have gone on to become, I hope, good friends. And let me tell you that this man is not only a master of the kitchen, he's also very capable of holding his own on an inflatable sofa ride sandwiched between my son and his. And I thank you for giving me a day off of that. A chef, a restaurateur, an author, the host of a plethora of cookery shows, a household name, the holder of three Michelin stars. I mean, I could go on. Most importantly, though, probably, I would say his role as a father to AC, a child so delicious I could eat him, and a husband to a brilliant sculptor, Beth. Tom Kerridge, thanks for having us over for lunch.
Thanks, mate. My God, that was an introduction. I'm exhausted. I didn't even read it out.
But I'm just walking in here today. So this is the second venue of the same name. The first one's in Marlow. This is just off the King's Road in Chelsea.
I see. It's a Butcher's Tap and Grill. So we've got, this is our sixth, I suppose, permanent restaurant stroke pub site. And we've got three in Marlow, three different types of pubs. One is the two Michelin star Hand of Flowers. One is the one Michelin star Coach. The other one is a Butcher's Tap and Grill, which is a community-based kind of place where there's no bookings. It has sport on the telly. It's beer and it's burgers and steaks and chips that are served in a cone. It's all the produce that is from the other two spaces. And so it's all the same meats and it's all the same sort of exciting things that, and levels that we look for, but we're just trying to make it a lot more kind of accessible, free, easy, nice kind of place to hang out. So it works really well. And we just thought, do you know what? Like, we wanted to do a second one. And when we saw this site in Chelsea, just off the King's Road, you know, we thought, well, why don't we do it here? Let's have a little go at it. You know, Chelsea's a cheap part of the world. We can get a nice we can get a nice pub here.
With two pubs shut every day, why not open up off one of the most expensive high streets in the world?
I know. it is a big risk. Actually, I've got to be honest. Like, Beth is the most supporting, amazing person ever. She's brilliant with the design and the vibe and the feel and building the business from the ground up to get to this point. And then she just kind of walks away now and lets us get on with, you know, and my team get on with making it run. But it is, you know, it's remortgaging houses and it's having a go at stuff, to have another go at doing something else, which is good. But it's because it's what I love doing. There's not... It obviously has to operate and work well as a business, but at the same point, it's got to be somewhere that, you know, it's somewhere that I love doing. Hospitality is great. It's what I love doing. I've done it for 32 years. And, you know, and this is the point where it starts getting really exciting. You're creating something, building something, learning a neighborhood and people. I like people, Kate, you know, that, like, I like hanging out with people and doing stuff. And, you know, if they're coming out into your place and having a nice time, then that's where we want to be. So, yeah, it's a super exciting opportunity. It's great. And also, if you can make it work when there's a cost of living crisis, everything is more expensive than anything has ever been, and the business still works, then, you know, we'll be in a stronger position in a couple of years. That's my thinking anyway.
Well, listen, there's so many tangents I could run off on here. But the first thing that struck me when I walked in today, right, having sat on a side, so since you were last on the show, we met remotely when you were on last time. Yeah. And then literally a couple of months later, I'm on holiday in Greece, as are you. We didn't know that we were staying at the same hotel. We run into each other in reception, have a little chat, and then say, oh, maybe see you later for a drink. Yeah, let's grab a coffee. And then literally ended up on holiday together for the rest of the week. It was brilliant.
Yeah, it was amazing. We were there for the whole time, weren't we? I think we flew a day before you, like going home. So we were there for quite a while. And it was a beautiful holiday. And I love Greece now. I love the Greek islands. I love, you know, Crete in particular. It's one of my favorite spaces to go. And again, it's actually because of so much about it is the hospitality, the people, but also the food and the simplicity of getting simple ingredients done well. I love Greece for that. And the weather was really nice. And it's just all...
Oh, it was beautiful.
We had the best time.
But what I loved was sitting on our sun lounges in Greece over many an afternoon cappuccino, chatting to you and Beth about how this all began. And then I walk in here today and here you are. You're running your end of the business. She's literally... sat there with a bank manager to her left and telling the electrician how she wants the lights dimmed to the right. And there it is, Team Kerridge in full flight. And yet this isn't even our day job, because the last time we were in this neighbourhood, you and I, was for Beth's exhibition at the Saatchi Gallery, you know, the world-famous Saatchi Gallery, just down the road, where her incredible work was exhibited. I mean, like, you two are... just so impressive on every level.
Well, that's very kind.
You are.
I think we've just been very lucky that both of us... So I found something that I wanted to do at the age of 18. Like I went into a kitchen. Maybe the industry found me. It might be the other way around. Do you know what I mean? Like, but found something where I wanted to be, an exciting, amazing industry that was just about... slightly left field where life, cooking late at night, working hard, playing with naughty boys in a kitchen with knives and fire and going out and partying. And it was all of that was brilliant. And Beth has always just been that artist. You know, she's always been that person. She went to Liverpool John Moores and then she went to the Royal College of Art as a sculptor. And, you know, it's always been, that's all she's ever done. That's who she is. But from that, we've always been very... proactive about doing stuff, work hard, say yes to things. And then, so like you say, Beth comes, you know, she makes art, but she also helps build businesses. She also is creative. She also, you know, looks at furniture, looks at insight, looks at the flow of buildings, tries to make those sort of things. We're interested in property design, interested in... So when those things fall into place, and then, you know, for me, you go from being a chef to being a restaurateur, to being an author, to being a TV presenter, to being a... And it's all just because they're
promoter of festivals, having your own festivals together. You two are just, I don't know, just work so well And I don't know if sometimes you're so busy, the pair of you, that you can see that. I hope that sometimes you catch a minute to look at the way you two are so in sync and how you complement each other and see what an incredible relationship you've built.
Yeah, we do know.
It's goals right there.
We don't have to say much to each other in terms of like when we have conversations about doing stuff, because we know actually together we do know that we get shit done. Do you know what I mean?
Like it's and like, you have a laugh.
Yeah, exactly. We have a laugh. If it's fun, but it's hard work. We're never scared of the hard work. Never, ever scared of the hard work. All the risk, right? Never scared of risk either. Like, I come from
punchy,
very little.
Though.
Yeah, but I come from nothing. I'm not materialistic. I like nice things. Don't get me wrong. I like nice things and I like doing nice stuff. But I don't, if it none of it existed, I would also still be happy doing what I'm doing because I was very lucky to have found...
Yeah,
my career path hasn't been about making money. My career path has been about living a life and doing stuff that's great. So high risk is also, I mean, the risk of losing everything is a real one, but it's also one that also I don't mind as much as most.
Do you not?
No, I
does
don't.
Does that not keep you awake at night?
No.
Wow.
But also because...
That's awesome, because I would be absolutely cacking it.
Yeah, but I also believe that I am not going to lose it.
Yeah,
and I also do,
there you
I
go.
Also go, if it does go horribly wrong, I'll just do it again.
It's a false fear because you know you believe in yourself.
Yeah, exactly. I back myself. I back myself and Beth every single time, every time. You know. But I also know, I've also, see, as you get older, right, Kate, you also realise, don't you? I mean, I'm sure there's, as you get older, you also recognise weaknesses as well, don't you? You know what you're not good at.
Yeah.
You know where your strengths are. And the things that you're not good at, you surround yourself with people who are good at those things so that you build a reliant workforce and a team collective spirit of trying to build those pieces around you, bits of jigsaw puzzles. And you can't do that when you're 20. Because you don't know.
You've got to experience it.
Exactly.
To know it.
You've got to experience it to know it.
So you've got a new book out, The Pub Kitchen, which is a continuation of the first book that you published 10 years ago.
Yeah.
So they bookend each other so beautifully. And as much as it is bursting with beautiful recipes, and it is, all the kind of food that you would really hope to find on a menu in the best pubs in the country. It's also full of love letters from you about pubs, pub life, what it means to people.
Yeah.
And what it's meant to you.
Yeah, and it's so important. And I think we probably all have early memories of pubs and going there as kids or sitting
but
in a beer
like
garden.
This. I mean, you and I grew up, because we're from the same neck of the woods.
Yeah.
I mean, like, a packet of Space Invaders, a bottle of pop, get out of here, come back at the
rusty
end when we're
climbing frame in the car park.
Like, yeah, exactly. Literally go and play in the car park. Yeah, like, can you imagine now?
Yeah, no, they are different, but they're still... There's still the social, yeah, exactly. They're the social spaces, you know, people having a great time. But, you know, times have changed. And the new cookbook is, I mean, it is a reflection on British pubs, but it's also, I think, a much, you talked about it, the first one to this one, the 10-year gap in between the two of the pub restaurant cookbooks. In between, there's been another 10 books. This is the 11th book. But the first one is called Proper Pub Food. This one is called Pub Kitchen. And it's a reflection on over those 10 years how pub food has changed, how it has moved on from we just use fish and chips or steak and kidney pudding or roast beef and Yorkshire puddings and steamed. Like, and that's why everyone just go, yeah, that's what a British pub is. Actually, that's not at all. We are the most exciting, wonderfully culturally rich and diverse countries in the world with that takes food influence from like global, from everywhere. And we've been able to put into a pub, because if you go to Spain, you eat in a tapas or a pinch bar, you go to Italy in a trattoria and you have pizzas or pasta restaurants that are amazing, you go to France, you have bistros and those kind of like great big brasserie style rooms where it's a very French cuisine, very Italian cuisine or very Spanish cuisine. British pub is now very, very different. There's nowhere else in the world where you could go and have like a Korean style coleslaw with blowtorch mackerel as a starter. Then you might have a chicken tikka curry done really, really nicely with homemade flatbreads, and then sticky toffee pudding for dessert. So you've gone to Korea, India, and you've gone to sticky toffee pudding for dessert. And you might even have that on a Sunday
and think nothing of it. And that's a wonderful reflection of how culturally rich, diverse our food influences come in, how good we are at cooking, and how we are globally owning an eclectic mix of good food in a space that is always about comfortable settings.
Yeah.
It's a great, that's what makes it amazing.
Would the menus have changed much between your first book and this book?
Yeah, oh, massively.
Yeah.
And also, pubs now have changed where we want, you expect quite good food now. You expect, it doesn't matter. If you go into any pub, you expect, you know, what's on the menu, what's on the chalkboard, what is there when you go in and see that you go, well, that sounds quite nice. Whether it's soup of the day in a crusty roll, that soup of the day is made fresh with some nice ingredients, cooked by maybe one or two people in the kitchen, and it's lovely.
Yeah.
Whereas before, it used to just be out of a freezer, dumped in a deep fat fryer, served to you. And sometimes that's not bad.
From the actually, cash and carry.
Yeah.
But frozen actually,
the levels of pub food now is very, very different. Expectation levels has definitely grown.
What you touched on there, Tom, about the spirit of the pub and its place in local communities leads me really nicely into my first question.
I don't know if you've seen, but a Christmas ad for Charlie's Bar, which is a pub in Ireland, has gone viral, and it's kind of won the ad battle for who's got the best Christmas ad. And the star of the ad is very much the pub. Have you seen it? Do you know about this?
I haven't seen it. No, I haven't seen much telly. I've got to be honest, mate. I haven't had much chance.
So no, this is not even on telly. This has gone viral, right? So the locals of this bar in Ireland, yeah, decided that they were going to make a short TikTok film to promote the fact that pubs are a real kind of safe space for people that are dealing with loneliness at Christmas.
Yes.
So it's shot by locals, featuring locals, and it's about an old man goes and lays flowers on a grave. He obviously lives on his own, and then having spent some time reflecting at a graveside, he goes into town and he tries to catch people's attention on the way into town, like waving to them, hey, how's it going? Gets blanked, you know, people are busy.
Yeah.
And then eventually stops at Charlie's Bar, and a couple are about to walk in with their dog, and he opens the door for them, pours a pint of Guinness, sits down. The dog goes over to him. They come over to him. Suddenly he's having his first conversation of the day. And it sort of lands the importance of the pub, that it goes beyond the pumps. It's the people, isn't it? And as somebody that's drunk in pubs, washed pops in pubs, owned pubs, run pubs, and their campaigns to preserve them, like, If you could make a case for the pub, for everyone listening who maybe is thinking, I'm going to do a dry January, they say, don't. Go and support your local pubs. Why do they need to do that?
Listen, you can still 100% do a dry January, but just don't drink alcohol in the pub. Go to the pub and support it. Because they are so intrinsic and so important to our society in terms of, now whether they're, listen, this is a posh pub in Chelsea, right? And it will have a community-based feel to it. It will have the locals that eat and drink in it. But, you know, they will also be spending, you know, it's top money for beer and it's expensive for steaks and it's whatever, you know. But it still will have a community about it. But even pubs that are on little council estates, like where we grew up, those sort of places are even more important because they're hubs, they're spaces. Now when there's a cost of living crisis, now when there's places where people can't afford to put their heating on throughout the day, that, you know, you talk about the old man in the advert and you go, well, actually, you know, if he's not going to put his heating on in the day, he can go and spend that time in the pub, hanging out with locals, friendly, staying warm, you know, conversation. Human interaction is so vitally important to our everyday lives, about feeling warm, happy, and pubs provide that more than anywhere else. They're so, so important. And they are also places, they're different. Lots of different pubs are different. They're also places of fun. They're also places that service a need. And, you know, as whatever you think of Wetherspoons, and listen, don't get me wrong, I'm not a big Wetherspoons fan, but I'm a huge fan of what they kind of represent in a pub marketplace, where they tick a box from all day. Like, yeah, they open really early in the morning for breakfast. So, you know, that space where Greasy Spoon cafes have died out, you know, Wetherspoons are up, and you know, there's loads of blokes in high-vis jackets before they go and get in their vans and go off to work, having breakfast in there before they disappear. Then you've got a space in the morning for coffees. Then you've got a lunchtime specials. Then you've got what goes on in the afternoon. Then you've got 2-for-1 booze offers. Then you've got Monday night curry nights. Then you've got, and they operate,
quizzes,
they almost, yeah, exactly. They operate almost on a 16-hour basis of providing something for someone. And don't get me wrong, they wouldn't be doing that unless there was a need for it. You know, they wouldn't be doing, they wouldn't open 16 hours if they didn't think that they could get enough revenue and people coming through the door. So they get people coming through the door because people want to be in those places. And they provide a sense of comfort, a sense of realization, a sense of familiarity. And that's where pubs are so important. And they're also something that's British. You don't have a pub anywhere else.
That is a really, really valid point because, you know, I've been lucky enough to travel the globe. And you're right. You really miss it when it's not there.
Yeah.
You know, because what's the Spanish equivalent, for example? A tapas bar?
Yeah, but tapas bars work really nicely because they have that similar
first,
sort of thing.
It?
It's food, but it is about going to have, but that's why those plates of food are very, very small. People, they hang out, they'll have a glass of wine. They're stood up in a tiny little area where they're having a glass of wine. They're having some, I don't know, some salted almonds and some anchovies and some bits and bobs or whatever's coming out. But it does provide that sense of community, but it's not quite the same. It's not quite got the same. They may well still have a screen on with the football, you know, or they may well still have that sort of thing, but it's not quite.
Yeah, it's a quite, it's a quintessentially British thing, isn't it?
Absolutely. It really, really is. It really is. And it does make it very magical and wonderful. And you think of it like a love story to pubs is a big walk through the Yorkshire Dales with the dog, and then you go into a pub that you find at the end of your walk and with an open log fire, and you have a pint of real ale and a pie with lovely mash. You know, this is your dream kind of like pub scenario, isn't it? And they exist and they're real, but they can't just exist on a Sunday when you want it to be there. For it to work as a business, it has to be Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. So they need support on a constant basis because we will and do miss them when they're gone.
Oh my God, yeah. And you also recognise the struggle. I know that in the Marlow branch of the Tap and Grill, kids eat free between 3 and 5 every day. Is that right?
They do, yeah. That's really important for me. So we've got, even though Marlow is, you know, it's got a very, very high net worth in terms of people that live there, mostly, there's still a huge amount of poverty everywhere you go. It doesn't matter, like just around the corner from here in Chelsea, there's people that are living in poverty. You know, food poverty and child food poverty is massive. You know, there's some areas, most deprived areas, more so. However, we still have a space there, is that still exists. It exists everywhere. So for me, we do Kids Eat Free, and we have people that eat with us 3-4 times a week because it's the one, and it's very important. We don't ever really talk about it. We let people know in the community that need it, and it's completely it tries to remove stigma, tries to make sure that they can at least have one warm meal a day if they need it, you know, those sort of things. And that's so important. And we also recognize we're in a privileged position to be able to do that as a business. But I think if you're in a community and you're part of it and you have the opportunity and the space to be able to give something back to communities, you should most definitely do it. And in hospitality, the pandemic, you look back at what happened there, the places that were the hubs of society, with the pubs, they were cooking meals for people in their little communities, they were shops, they were delivering, you know, food, they were doing whatever it was. The pub still became that kind of like hub, that kind of nucleus that a community built itself around. And, you know, and it's still very, very important now. So yeah, we do. Yeah, Kids Eat Free. Yeah, Kids Eat Free in Marlow.
Oh, I love that. I hope that lots of people listening, if they're in a position to extend the same sort of generosity, would take some inspiration.
Listen, hospitality has been the first industry. It's the one that makes the least money as an industry. Like you say, the pubs are closing all the time, but it's the first one to give something back. Again, it's because it's people that run it with a passion for people, and it's a vocation, not a profit-making
industry. I don't think anybody goes, I want to be a chef or I want to be a publican because I want to make loads of money.
No, they do it because you want to do it. And the beautiful thing about the hospitality industry is it's because it's surrounded up by other people that are in it
who do it for the same passion. You know, yeah, the brewers. Yeah, the brewers or the winemakers or the guy that grows the carrots or the gamekeeper that drops something off at the back door or the all of those sort of things. They're just full of people that are living a life that's surrounded by food and drink in a world that's driven by passion, you know. And if they can make a bit of money out of it and live a life, then great. But you're not going into it because
that's not your driver.
No, no, it's definitely not the driving force, no.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.
This week's episode is brought to you by Ridgeview, who have been producing world-class English sparkling wine since 1995. Their focus is on quality and sustainability from grape to glass, and their award-winning wine is revered all over the world. It makes every occasion truly something to celebrate. We're at Ridgeview's vineyard in East Sussex for a chat with the two people who sit at the heart of this English wine revolution. Tamara Roberts is the CEO of Ridgeview, and her brother Simon Roberts is the director of winemaking. This is truly a family affair. They're probably even more passionate as a family about wine than we are at White Wine Question Time, which, let me tell you, is some feat. So guys, welcome to the show. Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Lovely to have you here.
Give me the backstory. I mean, you've walked me through some of your many vines today. I've picked some of them. We're just entering into harvest. You're 25 years in. You've had to reframe people's view of English sparkling wine or English wine. It's always seen as a bit of a bottom of the barrel choice, or had been for so long, because we're not known for creating, probably due to the climate and the growing conditions, great wine, right?
No, I think that was fair, especially back in the day, wasn't it?
So. Yeah. I mean, I think you used to spend, I think we spent the first 10 years of getting people to taste the wines objectively was almost doing blind tastings and sticking our wines amongst champagnes and things like that and just seeing whether people would, and particularly when we had tastings here, and seeing whether they could pick out what was champagne, what wasn't. And half the time they couldn't. And half the time, or I suppose actually more than that, the majority of the times our wines would come up on top. And we would put ourselves against champagne. We wouldn't shy away from that at all.
Every time I've asked somebody a question here, the enthusiasm is tangible. Like you've created a community of local people that love what you produce. How lovely to take your dad's pipe dream and turn it into this. I mean, when you arrive here now, you could be in California, you could be in South Africa. There's this state-of-the-art restaurant with views over your vines. You can watch the sun go down with plates that are prepared by an amazing chef to pair with the wine. Wow, You guys have done good.
Thank you.
We've been busy. Yes.
And I haven't even scratched on the awards you've won. So if you're listening to this and you want to make the journey down, let me tell you, you won't travel as far as some of the people that we've met here today. As I lifted my first glass for the tasting this morning, a gentleman walked in who was a sommelier. He wasn't here on business. He's retired. He's travelled here because he's heard it was so good from Las Vegas.
It was amazing.
But he's planned an entire European trip around culminating his journey through Europe here because he'd heard that much good stuff about your wines. Can you walk me through some of the awards that have been given out to you and your wines?
I would say probably the one that stuck in my mind as the earliest one was the International Wine and Spirits competition back in 2005 for the 2002 Bloomsbury Vintage. That was probably the one where it really dawned on me just how big that was, because we had people queuing outside the winery, and because we had such limited stock, we could only sell them one bottle each.
Decanter. So that was...
So Decanter, explain who Decanter are to the uneducated ear, i.e. mine.
So Decanter Wine Magazine is the most widely published wine magazine in the world. And so we'd won a sparkling wine competition. And most wine competitions have champagne as a category and sparkling wine as a category. And Decanter is the only wine international wine competition that has sparkling wine and champagne in the same category. And so in 2010, we are still the only winery outside Champagne ever to win that award.
Wonderful stuff. Congratulations.
Thank you.
The first year that you produced a harvest, how many bottles of wine did you sell, Simon?
So that would have been about just under 20,000 bottles.
And this year you'll produce?
Probably about 600,000 bottles.
Yeah.
Wow, that's what 27 years looks like.
Yeah. Need to get a bigger cellar.
Constant.
Well, continued success. I am going to literally raise my glass to you. Thank you so much for joining us. And if you've got a hankering for a glass of something bubbly, then you know where to go. Head to ridgeview.co.uk to learn more about their amazing wine and buy some for yourself. Or if you're in Waitrose, you can always find it in there too, because life truly is for celebrating. But my next question is one that I hope you're going to enjoy jumping into.
All right.
Music is integral to a pub or a restaurant. It sets the mood, it soundtracks people's experiences. But what songs, if you had an old school pub jukebox, would you put on your jukebox to soundtrack you and the kind of experiences that have marked your life?
Oh my God, there's so many. Most of it, listen, I come from an age and a generation the same as you, where it's mostly about 90s indie stuff, but there's lots of, like, that world, you know. Oasis was my specialist subject on Celebrity Mastermind, mate. Like, it's like, you know, it was just like...
You did well with it as well, didn't you?
I did, yeah, I won.
You won!
It's like, two Michelin stars, first pub in the world to ever do it, and Celebrity Mastermind winner, you know. It's like, I also got an honorary doctorate in philosophy in the same week as well. My mum was so proud. Who needs GCSEs when you can win Celebrity Mastermind?
See, my specialist subject on Celebrity Mastermind was George Michael, and I didn't win, but I did very well. And he was still alive, and they aired it on, I think it was New Year's Eve, and he rang me, and I picked up, and he just went, "You camp bitch."
That's amazing. Yeah. Well, Liam actually emailed me and just went, "Well done." Yeah. That was it.
It was
top skills. Yeah. Great. Thanks.
You're happy with that? Yeah.
Amazing. I'll take that. Yeah. Man, a few words, but they're like, he should have the honorary doctorate in philosophy. That's what he should have.
One of my favorite descriptions of him was from Noel, who described Liam as so angry. He's like a man with a fork in a world of soup.
Yeah. I mean, I love spending time with him. He's very funny. He's a very funny character. He's very full on. He came to eat at the Hand of Flowers, and not once Did he never stop being Liam Gallagher? No. Like you 100% expect.
He got there early.
He spent the whole lunch with his cagoule on, like zipped up to the top. He ate, he was drinking espresso martinis from the start all the way through to the end. And when he finished at lunch, he moonwalked into the kitchen to thank all the chefs. It absolutely span there and heads out, like, but it was mega. It was amazing. He's absolutely brilliant. So listen, there's a soundtrack and music at Oasis.
That's your youth. But what about your childhood? Like, what was the music that takes you back to the 70s, early 80s, school life, Gloucester?
Yeah, so, I mean, music was has always been... I don't think I really, really found music. Like, I don't think most kids do until they're in their teenage years. When all of a sudden a band is saying lyrics... that suddenly makes sense.
Yeah.
That makes sense to you, whether it's a bit angsty or whether it's a bit love song because you're in love for the first time. We're talking about that when we were like before, like a bit of R&B or a bit of whatever or a bit of something. And it takes you into a world where you suddenly become, or you can imagine, your imagination can run away with you with music into being a grown-up world and imagining what this band is going through. Yeah. It is, and it's brilliant. So before that, so I think, listen, the first things that I was ever listening to were the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. My dad was a big fan of the Beatles and Rolling Stones before my mum and dad split up. So that was the first kind of thinking of music was, I remember, like, 8-tracks or tape decks with great big massive headphones,
hi-fi stacker system,
like that. Listening to the Beatles or the Rolling Stones or Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
I think you start out with what your mum and dad have got at home, right? That you have to listen to those. So I was the same as you, and we had a lot of 7-inches in the house. Yeah. And my mum and dad have got brothers and sisters, and they obviously all used to go to house parties and take their records with them, right? Yeah. So that you could play them at the house parties. But they all wrote their names on them. Yeah. And I loved, as a child, flicking through these 7-inches going, oh, that's my Auntie Jill's. Oh, that's my Uncle Brian's Rolling Stones. And they were tangible because you held them in your hand and then you had to clean them, to drop the needle on the record. Yeah. And, you know, that felt really exciting. And then, I suppose you're right, when you're a teenager and you start to get pocket money, did you do the thing of getting the bus into town to go to our price?
100% I did, So, and I remember buying, I think the first record I ever bought was Joe Boxer and Boxer Beat. Like, and I remember getting into town on the bus to go and get out and to go and buy that track and loving it, really. Like, it was massive. And there was a big thing this week about the, now that's what I call music compilation thing, but celebrating
40 years.
Yeah, 40 years, right? So I remember, I think the first one that I had, was Now 4. So it was 1984. Like, and it's like, oh my God. So I would have been like 11. And then that was the first point of me going, okay, music's cool. I like it. I'm really enjoying it and getting into it. And then I remember my best mate from school, from when I was 11, or one of those three of us that used to hang out, and he's really into his music and mad into Michael Jackson. And I remember Michael Jackson announcing that he was doing a tour and queuing up outside Gloucester Leisure Centre, which was the ticket agency, to buy tickets to go and see Michael Jackson at Cardiff Arms Park years. So I must have been 15, I think, to go and see the Bad Tour. It was just like, with Paula Abdul being the support act. And it's just like, but we queued up overnight to ensure that we got tickets to go to Cardiff to go and watch Michael Jackson. And that was the first real insight into, like, proper music and queuing and being a part of a festival and seeing live. I mean, nothing in my life, I've seen so many live bands and acts and I love them, but nothing in my life is ever compared to a Michael Jackson live show. Like, particularly as a 15-year-old, it was just like, this is mind-blowing.
But also, look at the work you'd put in to get those tickets, right? In the same way that to go
now you just click on a computer screen and just like, do you know what I mean? I'm really lucky. I managed to get Liam Gallagher tickets for the Definitely Maybe tour next year, right? And so it's like, brilliant. But I managed to get them by getting Alex, my PA, to get something, find someone online, get on it. Like, they all sold out in like 2 minutes. I had to pay top whack and I got a box. So I thought, I better take all my mates. So we've got a box going. It's the only way I could get tickets. But it was just like, but it's so much, it's like a lot easier now. Like, you go online, you wait, or you get a queue, or you get, queuing up overnight.
I sort of
that's missed proper that. Dedication.
Yeah, and like,
I'd still queue up overnight right now for a Liam Gallagher ticket.
Would you really?
Yeah, 100% I would. Wow. Yeah, if the only way you could get tickets is by getting in a queue at 8 PM tonight.
That's good.
To know that 9 o'clock tomorrow morning when it opens, you get tickets. I 100% would do that. Don't tell him that though. I know.
I won't tell him. I really won't tell him. I remember my mum and dad telling me that my mum, they had one of their first, I don't think they fell out over it, but my mum wanted to go and see the Beatles at the Odeon, where the Odeon is now in Cheltenham. Yeah. And they came to town, but it meant sleeping out to get the tickets. And my dad thought she was insane. And my mum was like, I don't care what you think, I'm going to see the Beatles. And they went to see the Beatles at Cheltenham Cinema. Can you imagine?
Yeah. That's I bet he's pleased he went now. Huh?
Yeah, but now I think, oh God, yeah, but yeah. But now I think about it, I think maybe like that's where my love of music started, because I had all these records in my hand. I had these stories about staying out all night because you loved the sound of something so much. It's massively important. And what plays in your pubs and your bars says so much about you as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a real reflection. But it also, music is key to mood. And it's massive, and it's a mood changer in it, and it creates energy in it, atmosphere. And, you know, I remember when I first getting into a kitchen as a chef, and, you know, if you've been out on a really, you've done a really late shift, and then you've all gone out afterwards, and then you're back in on the breakfast shift, so you've done 2.5 hours sleep, right? And you've got the breakfast, you've got to get ready, sorted for a hotel's worth of breakfast. It is 100% the prodigy being played at full blast in that kitchen to get you, like, I have to be
which
on an upper here.
You going to?
Anything. Outer Space, probably. It would be the early stuff. When, like, you know, it was before Breathe or Firestarter. So it would have been that. Like, so
early rave.
Yeah, exactly. And that kind of a bit of Charlie Says.
Yeah.
But that kind of energy you need. And they create moods. And that's why it's also driven into pubs and pub life and kitchen life. And, you know, chefs and musicians, they're very, very similar. I've been very lucky to have met quite a few. And
Hello.
We've set the fire alarm off.
Is that the toaster?
Yeah.
Or is it slightly?
So this is the lovely thing about day, like, trial shifts. That everyone's just assuming there's a trial shift.
Yeah.
And the fire alarm's going off for no reason. But the reality is the whole building could be on fire. No,
but
it's not. Okay, it's going off.
Health and safety. Health and safety.
See, not a single person cared.
No.
It was like an immense like, not getting me, I'm having a steak.
Exactly. Like, Bookie bars are on top. Guess where I went to Saturday night? I went to see the Prodigy.
Ali Pally.
Ah, it was good.
Mega, they're amazing.
So, I mean, like, Liam Howlett, I think, is probably one of my favourite human beings in the world. Yeah. Like, it's just a really stupendously good man.
Yeah, right? I don't know Liam very well. I've met him a couple of times, but I know Maxim quite well.
And Maxim. Yeah, and yeah. Maxim. So we're all there. And like, so last year they played a gig as well. It's become like, I mean, I hope that they continue to tour annually, but there is nothing like a Prodigy gig to make me feel 25 again.
Yeah. Yeah, they're so good. The energy is so good. The atmosphere. It's mega, isn't it? They are amazing. I was very fortunate. We went to the last one with that Keith did in the UK at Ali Pally again. And it was just, it's just such a special, one of the best gigs I've ever been to. And it's just...
I think they are possibly the greatest live act in the UK touring this year.
They're
easy.
Yeah, they're amazing. I think they bring good energy. Kasabian are amazing. Faithless, when Maxi was around, like, was just brilliant. You know,
when Maxi
was alive, energy that they kept giving as well. Like, if you think they're bands from the 90s, and now, and I know when we say it doesn't feel that long ago, but actually, your production team that sat in the room, you probably weren't even born then.
No.
None of you were born in the 90s.
Taylor wasn't. No. Literally, Taylor could be my child.
Right. So,
and she's way smarter than me. And
it's
Timmy.
Unbelievable, isn't it? It's like, and you go...
And Charlie, I maybe couldn't be your mother, but you are definitely smarter than me.
But to me and you, it's like the 90s, they were great times. And it doesn't seem that long
it's
ago.
That long
but then
ago,
all
like
of a sudden
it's
you
blink
go,
of an eye.
And then you go, actually, when you start talking about it, 1993, yeah, mate, that was like, that's 30 years ago, 30 coming out 31 years ago.
Oh,
you're like, oh my God. Like, yeah, it suddenly makes you go, oh, that's why my knees creak in the morning. Or that's why. Like,
well, you know, somebody said to me the other day, well, we've just recorded a 20th anniversary with Michelle McManus from when she won Pop Idol.
Well, yeah, when was that?
20 years ago she won.
No way.
Yeah, Tom. I've still got clothes in my wardrobe from that time that I think fit me. Who's the fool?
Yeah. Yeah. She done all right over those 20 years?
She's done great. Do you know what? Good. What a lovely, lovely woman.
Yeah,
and
great.
Then, you know, the year before that, it was Gareth Gates with Will Young. And we've just had Jason Fox on Foxy.
Yeah, he won Celebrity SAS, didn't he?
And Foxy said, you know, he said, Gareth could have made the SAS. He could have actually made the cut. You go, wow.
Yeah.
And there was us every week going, are you all right? Because you've got to face the phone vote. Yeah, turns out he's more than all right, thank you.
Turns out you're right. He could have done undercover operations somewhere in a jungle.
Could have gone undercover for 30 years and been fine, thank you.
Maybe he has. Where has Gareth Gates been?
Exactly, there you go. Not just Panto.
Yeah.
Yeah. What about the song that you... that reminds you of Beth and of AC?
So there's always quite a few that we'll always pick and like get into and enjoy, and tracks that will, like AC comes and sit, we're quite fortunate because we talked about the festival business briefly earlier, and he'll come and watch live music, and he'll come and see things, and he'll come and really get into it. But actually, one of the bands that have been amazing, another amazing band live that never really made it super massive, but they were, like, I think absolutely mega, is the Stereo MCs.
Oh, Connected. Like,
Connected. So, and...
Are they our neck of the woods as well? Are they Bristol?
I don't know, actually. I don't know.
Yeah, I should know that.
I don't know.
I don't know why I should know
One
that.
Of the girls, she lives out in Portugal and then comes back every summer to do a show. Like, and
they're great.
They've done loads of the Pub in the Park festivals.
Yeah, so Pub in the Park, for those that haven't been, go. It's like the pub on steroids in your local park with the best live music. So you played My Local Park last year, year before. You play it every year. So I came down with Ben and we saw Sister Sledge.
Yeah,
they were bloody amazing.
Mega. Yeah, they were really good. So I don't really have much to do with the music bookings and that.
Do you not?
I try and influence it a little bit, and I'll try and push it. But Craig David was brilliant. He's mega live.
The best bands. You do get the best bands.
But that's it. We have to also try and connect to a lot of different people, not just quite niche.
Yeah.
Like, this is what I really like. But DJ sets go down really well. I tell you, it was absolutely amazing. His example.
Great, isn't he?
Oh my God, the energy. Yeah. I like, he's just brilliant. He's coming back again next year to do Marlow. And he was just amazing. But yeah, Stereo MCs and Connected. And
because does AC like that?
Loves that, like that bit. Yeah. Like, and you know what kids are like when they get a thing in their head that they're like, so yeah, and they were amazing live. And when I remember when they did their first gig at Pub in the Park, they did, nothing happens. He just comes on stage and then just comes up to the mic, and he's quite an intimidating character, and he just goes, why don't you all come a little bit closer? Like that, and everyone's just like, oh my God. Okay. And then it kicks off
that.
And it's just brilliant. Yeah. So Stereo MCs is something that always reminds me of Beth and Ace, is the time that they come together. There's also like, he'll sing along to ABBA tracks in the car and he'll do whatever. But actually tracks like that where he's beginning, I mean, he's talking about for Christmas this year, wanting a guitar. And it's like, okay, maybe we won't, because I know he'll have it. He'll play with it for about 14 minutes and then it'll sit around until forever. Until maybe he's, I don't know, 16 and then starts deciding he wants to play it again. So maybe we'll rent one for Christmas Day.
listen, you say this, right? Denise Welsh used to be the same, right? When I worked with Denise back in the day on Loose Women, and she had a young son, Matt. And she'd be like, oh, he's got this band and they want to rehearse in our garage and he keeps asking for keyboards. And I keep saying to him, for goodness sake, Matt, you know. And there they are, selling out stadiums around the world. The 1975, absolutely massive. So, you know,
They're not doing bad, are they?
No. So maybe get him that guitar.
Maybe we'll get him the guitar. Well, there's a drum kit that's been in the living room for 2 years that he plays every now
he's
and then.
He's got form.
That's it, yeah. He's got form. He comes in, smashes it, bangs it, makes as much noise as possible, plays the one rhythm that he's learned and then disappears again. Like, Yeah, like some sort of, like a rock star. Comes in, plays a one track, walks off.
He is a rock star. Yeah. He's a beautiful young man. He really is. There's something very special about your child. I fell very much in love with him on holiday.
Yeah, he's a good laugh. He's good. He drove off this morning. Beth drove off like he rang the window down and just shouted out of it, "See you later, poo-poo head," and just drives off. He's just like, "Okay, mate, bye. Yeah. See you later. Have a good day at school.
Love you.
Yeah. Cheers, mate."
He's still in charge of his rugby team.
Yeah, we say in charge. I'm more like a classroom assistant. There's a couple of coaches, and then there's another two or three coaches that are there to kind of like help move them around or do the things. We know I don't set up the drills and the things that they're learning, but I try to, we help work with them.
I love it.
It's great. It's like my Sunday morning thing that we both go and he plays rugby. I mean, he absolutely loves it, but you know, it's good that we do this thing together. Like, yeah. It's great. And it's quite weird because obviously I didn't grow up with a dad. There was a dad in my life. My mum and dad split when I was 11, but even before 11, my father wasn't really there much at all. So there's been no father figure as such in my life in terms of working out how to do it. Do you know what I mean? There's been no... So I'm learning to be a dad at the same time as he's learning to be a son. I quite like the journey, the adventure we're on. I've got nothing to gauge it against. Only, I don't know, what you see on the telly of where people's perfect lives are. And it's certainly... Life is not like that. Do you know what I mean? Like, social media and television programs is not how dads really are. Like,
is like... But you know what? You stole my son's heart, because when we came home from Crete, before we even got home, actually, just said, "Tom's a really good dad, you know. Tom's a really good dad." And that was his observation of you. And the fact that you were always like, you know, up for getting in the water with them, up for getting on the sofa. You really struck a chord with my boy.
I think a lot of that comes from having ADHD. So if you have that, like, I can never sit still. The last holiday we went with some friends. And I didn't realise that obviously they'd all been talking about it. That I never, like, I think it was day four. It was the first time I sat down on a sunbed that wasn't running around with the kids or doing that, building a sandcastle. Let's go on a sofa. Let's go for a swim. Who wants what for lunch? What are we going to do? Like, at concert? But then I sat down on the sunbed that Claude, who I was with, shouted over to Beth. We go, Beth, it's his day four. He's French. It's day four. He has sat down. It's the first time. That is it. Now, like, I hadn't they'd obviously all been talking about it. Like, it was like,
you were
okay,
like a spinning top. Right. Yeah, but I'm a bit like that on holiday. You need a few days to just slow down.
Yeah, and it's good. It's good. It's great. You just got, I love it. But what's the point of being on holiday with the kids if you're not going to be on holiday with the kids?
Exactly.
Because in my head, right, he's coming out to eight now. I've got another 8 years before he's like, "Shut up, dickhead. I don't even want... Why are you even talking to me? You don't come near me. You're cramping my style."
I think you're being quite generous with age.
Yeah. Okay. 5 years.
My final question to you is wrapped around the decision that you make to say yes to things, because, you know, Beth proposed to you, you said yes, you just dived in, right? And you've already told me that you don't lie awake at night feeling the fear like most people would. So what have been the most gutsy and important yeses you've said, apart from the "I do" to your good lady wife?
Yeah, I was just too terrified to say no.
You know she's going to break one of your legs for that.
I know. No. Well, I think no is the... I genuinely think no is the worst word in the English language. I just think it's all... Listen, I get from a personal perspective, in personal space, no is a really powerful word that should be said. But no, in terms of its connotation, because it just feels like you just shut a door. Every time you say it, it closes something. Like, no, it's just like, no, well, what about maybe, or okay, or we could try, or yes. Like, nothing grows. You don't grow unless you say yes to stuff. You'll never get out of that comfort circle, that comfort zone that you're in, which is could be really nice. You're never going to grow as a human, as a professional, as anything that you do, if you say no to stuff. And so many people are base their lives on, what do I get out of it? Short term as well. What's my short term gain for saying yes to this? Well, actually, in pretty much everything I've said yes to, which is almost everything, like, it's not, none of it's about short-term gain. It's always about, well, if I say yes, who knows what will happen long-term. It's always a long game.
But I think you're not scared of what happens if it, if that yes turns into a, you know, into something that looks like failure. You don't fear failure, so therefore you don't fear.
No, I like experience. I like,
yeah,
I like the experience. The pandemic was the worst thing ever, right? And it was horrible. But a little bit of me really enjoyed it, right? In a weird way. Like, I really enjoyed the wrong word. Liked the challenge of structuring and running my businesses. I felt so under pressure. I felt sick every day. It was horrible not knowing the sense of responsibility for 250 work friends and colleagues and people that you're with. And, you know, I'm trying to work out how you can help solve and save their lives and make them feel comfortable and trying to, I relished that challenge. I really, enjoy is such a the wrong word. I can't think of the right one to use, but I
thrive.
Yeah, yeah. And it was one, that point of,
do you think that's when you come,
yeah,
good?
Yeah, like,
is in the face of almost pressure, that adversity.
Yeah, put me under pressure and I'll work out a way and I'll try and solve it. And I'll try and solve it. And I can't tell you I will solve it, but I'll try, 100% try. And there's no such thing as making a, none of those decisions are bad. They're only really bad decisions if you don't learn from them.
Yeah.
Or you do it again, or you do, because things that go wrong, all those mistakes, everything that happens where you lose. So we've lost so much businesses. We probably, I don't know, pandemic probably on paper was a paper loss of around about four million quid. We lost 4 million, right? Real terms cash was about 1.5. We lost 1.5 million
Jesus,
quid, right?
Tom.
If not more. So there's still a paper loss of 2.5 million that in businesses that are, we're having to make work to generate, and that's, you know, that's us. There's other businesses that have lost loads more, and there's other places that have had to shut, and there's loads of,
yeah.
But you've got to start crying. Now, I quite like the pressure of that. I don't like losing the money. I don't, because you just got to try and make it work and try and grab it and go for it. And I like, but that's it. Those are things that happen, and those things that you say yes to, or they're mistakes. But you can learn from them and you can grow from them and you can adapt from them. The biggest risks and things that we've done to try and, I think, there isn't anything that I've seen as a massive risk. I've seen everything as an adventure. I just see it as an adventure. Life is an adventure. Listen, we were just talking then that these guys weren't around in the 90s where we were living our best lives,
yeah,
right? None of these people were born. And then in 20 years' time, it's like, we're done, right? We could be like really cool 70-year-olds, right? And we could be having
God, we're going to be 70 in 20 years' time, yeah, Tom.
So we could be really cool 70-year-olds.
That's just hit me like a
right,
truck.
I know. And having a great feel time sick, and do whatever else. But like, in the reality of it, the best times are behind us. We should be in a secure position. We are looking like at going, you know. And that comes real quick. That
it
comes
does,
real quick.
That's because the 90s were a blink ago. And do you know what, though? I'm bloody glad that I lived every minute of it. I worked hard. I played even harder. I drank it all in.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
No hangover. Just loved it.
Exactly as I think you should live.
The rest of your life.
Of your life, your whole life. You should live your life like that. Because what's the worst thing that can happen? The reality of it is how bad can it actually be?
Well, I mean, sometimes when the worst has happened, actually, that's where the greatest lessons have sat for me.
Massive, yeah.
You know what? Humility is no bad thing. That's for sure. I don't think success has taught me anywhere near as much as, and I'm not going to call it failure, reconfigurating.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly it. You learn so much from it, and you could reset button, default, or what, and what have I learned? And you've grown. So you've taken that comfort zone, yeah, you've stepped outside of it. It's been really uncomfortable. It's all gone horribly wrong. But now that zone is bigger because you know how to deal with it again. Mm. And then you can just keep growing.
I'd love to go back and tell younger people, like, don't be afraid. Like, things will go wrong, but just learn from it. And you will come to be really grateful for this shitty experience.
Yeah,
you
yeah,
just want to keep going around hugging people, going, don't worry, it's all going to be fine.
Yeah, the really bad experiences and horrible. Now, you know, some of the things we're most proud of are people that have been in our business. We owned a business nearly 19 years ago, and there's people that have grown and been in that business for 17, 18 years, people that have been with us from the beginning, some that we're still in contact with that were pre-opening that business or part of the opening team. Some of the opening team are coming back and rejoining us in January. Like, there's lots of different things. And in that time, those people have gone on to do, you know, different things, got married, have kids of their own, do build relationships, open businesses, close businesses themselves, come back into us. And they're all horrible mistakes that they go through. We've had, you know, people that be with us whose lives they've lived through us have got married and divorced and got like and you go and you're constantly putting an arm around and going, well, this is what happened when something like this happened to me, or this is what happened when something, or I lost a job there, or we lost a load of money here, or this went wrong there. And there is nothing you can do apart from, but we're better people from learning from it. You learn from this experience. And right now, the hurt is real bad. But you just got to go, okay, I can get through this. And time is a massive healer. And it's so much easier. It's such an easy thing to say when you've got that experience of being 50.
When you're set here at 50.
And you go, yeah, and you go, we've done it. I've seen that. I've been through that. It's really horrible right now, but it does get better. And you have learned from it. And it will make you a better, stronger, more brilliant person.
But don't you think as well that the fact that you bounce back from all of these bumps, knocks, difficulties, whatever you want to call them, you learn to have a little bit more faith in yourself.
I'm also quite lucky that I believe in myself and I back myself every single time. And that is a self-confidence thing that...
It's extraordinary though, because you weren't... I mean, where does it come from, Tom? Where does... Because your brother's not like that, is he?
No, my brother's not. No. He's just celebrated his 30th year working for Marks & Spencer's in Gloucester at their food hall store where he was, you know, works in the warehouse and the
Totally happy with his lot.
Very happy.
Just chatted to him at your birthday. He's a super lovely guy, but you're very different characters.
Very different,
So where does this... It's not a supreme confidence, but it is this kind of... quiet confidence you've got. It's like when you say, if it all went tits up, you just start again. I don't disbelieve you.
I don't know. I know I'm very lucky. I've never felt I've had to prove anything to anyone. I've always believed I'll be all right, even from a young kid. I've always thought, well, I'll be all right. I know school wasn't for me. I wasn't a naughty boy at school. I was hung around with the naughty boys, but I wasn't the naughtiest. I wasn't bad. I just knew that remembering stuff and repeating it onto a page means that you're clever isn't real. Life is not like that. And I knew that from quite early on. So I always thought, well, I back myself to do something with my hands or something, what it is, I'll be all right. I've got a work ethic. I've got a sense of reality of life. Where do I focus it and check? I don't know. And I don't know where it really comes from or where it's arrived from, but it's always been...
Such a great thing to have.
It's also very lucky. I know that because so many people have self-doubt and
imposter syndrome.
Yeah, and I have that quite a bit. And then I go, well, it doesn't really matter, because that's the other thing I've learned, that I have met CEOs of multi-billion pound companies. I have met corporate leaders. I have met top politicians. I have met, they are all blagging it.
Just
they
like
are
us.
All making it up. None of them. Some of them have really found their strengths and what they're good at and have backed themselves and have done really well because they know they're that. But then when you talk to them, the reality of it is they're just like a normal person that has somehow found their way into that position where they're seen as a position of power. But the reality is that it isn't.
It's like pulling the curtain back in The Wizard of Oz, isn't
it's
it? And you
massive,
go, you're just like us.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, mate. Okay, you're exactly the same. Yeah. And then when you start talking about other stuff, and then you've got to remind yourself, well, this guy might be able to do whatever he does on a corporate, understand a corporate spreadsheet of working out the balance of profit and loss over a multi-billion pound company and future investments and what it gets. But you can't cook two Michelin stars, can you, mate? Do you know what I mean? So you go, okay, well, that's fine.
Horses for courses.
Exactly. You go, well, you're quite good at that, but I'm actually better at what I do. You just remind yourself of that, I think, all the time. Find your skill set and play to your strengths.
Well, I would back you all day, every day. Thank you for your time. I know that this is like a key time for you. A new restaurant opening, a new pub opening. The last thing you need is me wanging on in your ear, but you're very kind to give me the time.
It's really interesting. They've got to make mistakes. We've got our fire alarms going off and we've got to have overcooked steaks and the drinks being dropped and people spilling stuff on someone's expensive cashmere coat for us to, you know, it wouldn't be an opening without it.
I can't wait. Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, mate.
How lovely was that? In conversation with Tom Kerridge, who very kindly has invited us to stay for lunch. So whilst I go and fill my face, you can go and fill your ears with more brilliant episodes from culinary greats. We've got episodes with Rick Stein, Dame Prue Leith, James Martin, Rosemary Schrager, Simon Rimmer, Marcus Waring, Greg Wallace, John Turow, Lisa Faulkner and Faye Ripley, all in our back catalogue. I'll be back on Tuesday with more vintage conversations from the White Wine Question Time cellar. And if you want to chef like Tom and create some of the very best pub grub there is, his new book, Pub Kitchen, is out now and would make Faye a marvellous Christmas present. I'm just saying. Until then, thanks so much for your company. Now, where's that menu?
White Wine Question Time is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.